Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schleinkofer. Today we have Jay Wimpy, current president of the American Civil Defense Association. How you doing, Jay?
I'm doing very good. How about you?
Great. We have Todd DeVoe on the line also. He's the host of EM Weekly Podcast.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Hey, Jay. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
So, Jay, we've had a couple of private conversations before today, and they went really well. You're a great guy, and you have a wealth of knowledge on this subject. I guess that's one of the reasons why you're the current president. And so can you tell us a little bit about your background with Civil Defense Association and where the association's headed?
Yes, I can. Just to give you a little bit of a history, the Civil Defense used to be part of the mission of the Department of Defense, but with the advent of the MAD, or Mutual Assured Destruction Doctrine, I guess the government kind of dropped that, and the DOD actually dropped that mission, and at that time, there were some professors at the University of Florida that decided to pick that mission up, and they got permission to use the logo, and they created the Civil Defense Association, the American Civil Defense Association, and it has existed since that time. It has definitely changed a little bit. We are presently redesigning our website. It should be up and going in a week or two. We've actually been in operation in our current configuration and location for roughly 15 years. And our mission is to help inform people and empower them to prepare themselves. We have tried working with the government to try and encourage some better preparations by the government for the people. However, we have been largely disappointed in that effort, and so we're now concentrating on helping people, and we think with our new website we will be able to deliver a lot more information a lot more efficiently to help people prepare themselves for any disaster, man-made or natural disaster.
Well, I'm on your website now, and it's really nice. You guys have a dramatic different website from what it used to be. It's really good. I'm impressed. You've got a lot of information there, and you even have a journal that you put out. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how often it's put out?
The journal has been, put out, I guess, since about 1968. It has changed formats over the years and such. I would say in 2005, it kind of reached its current format. It varies a little bit. Sometimes we get 6 issues a year. Sometimes we're down to 2 issues a year. It kind of depends on how much information that we can generate. We generate a lot of information from the staff, actually the board of directors and the people directly associated with the organization. We also review outside sources, and if we find some good information, we get permission to reprint that, and we put that in the journal as well. Basically, we are trying to build a body of information that would be helpful for people to help organize themselves.
That's
or to
awesome.
help prepare themselves for whatever disaster may come.
That's awesome.
Jay, I got a quick question for you. How do you see your organization fitting in with the total picture of emergency response and emergency management and the mission of, say, FEMA and or the local disaster response?
So I'm familiar with the a lot of what FEMA is trying to do. I have a lot of information from FEMA. We deal with the Red Cross. We actually coordinate our activities a little bit with the Team Rubicon and the BOAD group, which is volunteer organizations active in disaster. I would say our focus is somewhat unique. We focus on long-term survival on an individual basis, whereas the other organizations are, and FEMA is focused on disaster response and short-term remedies. Are you ready to handle from FEMA? They do a pretty good job of outlining the problem, but their basic response is, you know, if you can hang on for a few days, we will come and rescue you. And we feel like that is a not the best option for most people. You know, we've learned through recent hurricanes and things of that nature that the government isn't probably prepared, and at least from what I've heard from FEMA, they're now openly admitting that they may not be able to get to you for a good long time in any sizable disaster. And so it's good for people to be more prepared than they are, and not necessarily depend on the government or others to come and rescue them in the event of a disaster. So we're long-term survival, whereas, you know, you should be able to survive and perhaps rebuild society from a situation that is could be quite adverse.
Yeah, I have read that report that came out from FEMA, the FEMA Higher Education Program. It's entitled Building Cultures of Preparedness, Report for the Emergency Management Higher Education Community, dated January 2019. And essentially they say we failed to build a culture of preparedness. Maybe we should rethink this top-down process and build it from the bottom up.
Yeah, well, and that's essentially what we have tried to do. We've tried to coordinate our efforts with the local emergency management people. We've been met with some, well, not necessarily open arms, I guess, with some, and you know, they're a little bit unsure. We respond through what we're doing. We feel like we can help people who, you know, much better than they are, and than they would normally do. We come at it from the philosophy that people are very capable, and is what they need is good, solid, scientifically sound, authoritative information about how to prepare themselves. Just as an example, the Are You Ready handbook, it says in the advent of some chemical release or perhaps some biological weapon, so they tell you how to go into an inside room without windows, put wet towels under the door, seal yourself up with duct tape and plastic. And then they say, wait for us to tell you when to come out. And we feel like that would be somewhat unworkable in a lot of situations. And so, you know, we put out the information based on the size of the room and the number of occupants. This is how long you can stay in the room before you would suffocate.
Yeah.
And where people are putting out CO2, and they need to know that they will be able to feel when there's too much CO2 in it. But it gets to about 3% in the air. Breathe heavily, and you'll know when you're, there's a lot of CO2 there. Basically, you don't necessarily die from lack of oxygen, but, your lungs get real irritated if there's too much CO2, but we feel like people can actually use that information and they can decide on their own how long that they can stay in that room if you give them the correct information.
Yeah, and that's good information. I've on your former website, I got in there and rooted around in your resources area, and I found a lot of great information that you guys have produced on various topics, and it's really good information. Some of it was a little dated, but it's still very good information. And I'm looking at the resources tab right now. You guys have Survival Store, Radioactive, which I believe is talking about radios.
The Radioactive section in the journal talks about radio communication. Past rules, we cover everything from food preservation and food dating. It's interesting to note that there have been some riverboat there was canned food in there. It was actually in glass bottle with cork, cork stopper that was covered with wax, and I'll be, you know, at the bottom of a river. It's nice and cool and dark, but there have been a bottled fruits and vegetables that were preserved in that mold for over 100 years, and then when those was brought out, it was analyzed, found to be some of the vitamins had deteriorated. However, the calories and the taste and such were still there. So we think people need to know that, and you know, the dates on the can that we receive today are nice to have, I guess, but as long as the can maintains its integrity, the food and will still be good. I was just going to say water. You know, some people advocate that you have to get your water storage every 6 months. And basically, I've done quite a bit of work with water, water treatment and such. I know that it, as long as the water is prepared properly, you put it in a container, the water will actually remain fillable as long as the container remains viable and closed. So, you know, we just think that people need the facts. They can make their own decisions after that. We provide what I consider scientifically sound advice on how to survive long term in the event of whatever emergency may come. And I think you know, we're definitely in line for a few emergencies in our future. And again, coming like freight train, but you don't know quite when they're going to get here, but they're definitely on their way.
Right. So your organization has it addresses every kind of emergency, both the terrestrial, as in the sun or EMP, and all the way to the local flooding and other regular natural disasters that, that people experience on a fairly annual basis, correct?
Yes. Yeah, we try to cover essentially everything. We used to have the saying that if you're prepared for nuclear war, then you're prepared for essentially everything. More recently, we have added chemical and biological warfare for that. But basically, if you're ready for those types of disasters, then many of the smaller local disasters can be handled pretty good. But we believe that people should actually plan to evacuate, you know, especially if you're in a low-lying area that is prone to flooding. We also believe that, like, you know, good solid advice on an earthquake. I live here in Utah. We're kind of an earthquake-prone area. We're actually a little bit overdue for our next big one. We should be seeing a 7 to 8 type earthquake probably in the next 50 to 100 years. They say we're actually about 50 years overdue for that. But, you know, in some areas, they talk about the triangle of life for earthquake preparedness. But if you look at the statistics, most people in the United States die from falling furniture and falling freeway overpasses. That's what's caused most of the fatalities for earthquakes. So, you know, we encourage people to put restraints into the wall to support, say, entertainment centers or, you know, tall, heavy-type furniture, and then to just be prepared, you know, not to run outside or, you know, standing in a doorway is a pretty good thing to do, maybe necessary, but finding a good, solid piece of furniture and just under that is probably one of the best things.
Right. Todd, you're familiar with that kind of preparation, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, this is what we teach when we teach our SHIP programs and things like that. Yeah, for sure. I think that he's spot on as far as with preparing the home for those earthquakes. And you know, it's the time to kind of chit-chat a little bit about that. But I know one of the things that people don't do is they kind of play gambling with the insurance. And realistically, to recover from that disaster, whether it be earthquake or flood, you have to be properly insured, and I think that's important to tell people as well.
Yeah, we would suggest, you know, having insurance, and I have flood and earthquake insurance. I guess it is part of my personality, in a way. I know originally you asked a little bit about my personal background in preparedness, and, you know, I've always just looked at situations and thought, you know, a minimal amount of preparation up front, I'm sure, helped you out a lot. You know, anything from getting stuck in your car in a winter storm, to having proper flotation devices and maybe a rope and a few things like that when you're out on a boat. So I just think that it's better to be safe than sorry, and I'm kind of a safe type person, I guess. I remember finding some old civil defense pamphlets with some Civil Air Patrol material that my dad had. He was actually in the Civil Air Patrol for a little while. And I hung on to those pamphlets thinking, you know, they might be useful. And then when I ran into the American Civil Defense Association back in 1989, and I found what we call the Dream Book, Preston Kearney's Nuclear War Survival Skills. And I was absolutely thrilled to have that amount of information, you know, good solid technical information about what to do. And I would like to highly recommend that book as well. You can sell that on the website. It's very much worth your while. It covers everything from, you know, what kind of store to building an improvised wheat grinder, improvised cold weather clothing, you know, just about anything you could imagine is in that book. It's a very good starting place. It also takes care of a lot of the myths associated with nuclear war. I think we've been taught by the media and the movies and such that nuclear war is a hopeless event, but in reality, what we know with the bombs that were used on Japan and the open air here in Nevada, that you know, people can actually survive a nuclear event if they're not close to the physical impact. You protect yourself from the radiation, and life can and will go on if you're prepared for it.
Yeah, I agree. I spent 12 years in the Army National Guard as a nuclear biological chemical NCO of a NBC defense company. We had a platoon of reconnaissance, four platoons of decontamination, and one platoon of tactical smoke. And that was our mission, to provide the NBC response to the division that we were assigned to. And that was there was a lot of interesting facts came out, and trying to correlate, you know, the things that I knew working in the field and the things that were coming out in movies and stuff. It's like being a cop, you know. You see, we're in the Army, you know, you see the guys on TV handling a weapon that is one taboo because they have their finger on the trigger all the time, and they laze people with the muzzle, and I mean all kinds of goof ups that happen. It's important to understand the truth about nuclear weapons, other threats. Talking about threats as an organization, what do you guys see as a cascading threat? Starting at the top, you know, maybe your top three to five threats.
Well, you know, I guess you could say the fact that our government is spending an extra $1 trillion a year that they don't have, and no one seems to be concerned about it, and they don't seem to be changing their trajectory there. And I believe that we will suffer an economic collapse in the relatively near future. You know, I look at the food production in the United States. I know that basically we're kind of at a balance right now. We do not have a substantial grain reserve. It was actually federal law at one time that they would maintain a substantial grain reserve, but that is gone. And so we are actually exporting food during the late summer and fall when we're harvesting. But during the late winter and early spring, we're actually importing food. We do that all the time anyway. We import a lot of fruits and vegetables and things of that nature from outside the country. But once the economy fails and people are not assured of getting paid for providing the goods and services that we enjoy every day, then there's a good bet that we will go without that for quite some time. And if people outside our country stop taking our dollars that we're foolishly devaluing, then eventually we will be in a bad way. There will be inflation where most people won't be able to afford the basics that they need to live. I see that as kind of a big one, while that's pretty much assured of coming. I've got to admit I'm a little bit of a religious person. I study the Bible and Revelation. I think John is describing nuclear war. You know, when the elements start melting with fervent heat and the earth and heaven, roll together as a scroll. If you're a man 2,000 years ago, you don't know what a mushroom cloud looks like. And I think he did the best. I think he did the best he could to describe a mushroom cloud, and even the stars falling from heaven. Basically, a reentry vehicle looks a lot like a falling star. That's a big one. And and I've actually seen the moon turn red when we had forest fires in this area. There was one night in particular, I remember I was driving down from southern Idaho, and there were substantial forest fires there, and the moon came up over the horizon, and it was literally blood red, with all the smoke from that forest fire. It was really kind of interesting. So I think we could actually see a nuclear war. As I mentioned before, I was in the aerospace business making missiles in quite a few years, so I know the weapons exist, and I know the capability exists, and so I just thought that something might happen to where we somebody actually uses some of those weapons, and someday. And then there's always the EMP threat, where we know that some enemies like North Korea and Iran are actually practicing with high altitude detonations. At least a dozen countries have the nuclear technology. Probably three dozen countries have the missile technology to create the EMP threat. And the scenario described in the Michael Forstner book, one second after, I believe describes what would happen if you turn off the electricity or even the running water in our society right now. You will see some very significant issues. It can and could happen. So, if you look at the severity of the consequences, even if it's a relatively remote probability that it will happen, eventually, it's worthwhile preparing. And with an EMP, if you turn off the electrical power, all of a sudden, everything that you, all the systems that support you now that you take for granted, like clean running water, grocery delivery to the stores, and even the production of those deliveries. I work with industry right now. I know that most refineries are largely dependent on grid power. So, the fuels that power our equipment that make our food basically are dependent on the electrical grid. So, our very lives are dependent on the technological bubble that we depend on right now. And that bubble could be disrupted in many different ways. It's worth, having individuals prepare for that to essentially ensure their own preservation.
That was a good overview of just a few. There's an organization out there that got a big grant from some benevolent group, it's at a university. I can't remember the name of the university, but these professors are reinventing civil defense. Have you heard about that?
No, I hadn't heard about that. We're always interested in joining forces and at least showing them what we have, what we can contribute, and learning what other people are doing. I was very interested in civil defense radio and everything that you're doing as well.
Yeah, thanks. Well, Reinventing Civil Defense, they're focused solely on a nuclear exchange. That's what their focus is, at least was when I looked at their stuff last year. I haven't gone back to look at their website lately, but they had a singular focus of nuclear weapons, and hopefully they've broadened their scope and taken a closer look, because I know both myself and Michael Mabee, the author of the Civil Defense book, we've both reached out to them and offered our assistance, but we haven't heard anything back from them yet. But hopefully one day we'll maybe even get them on the radio show here.
Yeah, that would be great. I know the government has made some efforts, from time to time. The fact that they designated some buildings as fallout shelters, that was supposed to be a stopgap measure in preparation, I guess, for actually making some real shelters for the population. I think it's incredible that the Swiss have done what they have done for an investment of something like $30 per person per year. They have built an incredibly effective civil defense system. Basically, they have underground shelters for over 100% of the population. Their shelters are stocked with food and supplies. They have underground hospitals and such. And for roughly $30 a year per person, you can build something like that over time. The United States, on the other hand, invest roughly 50 cents per person per year. That pretty well gets bureaucracy that is emergency management. But
yeah,
there's nothing really beyond protection for some of our elected representatives. No real arrangement to help the masses of people.
What do you think of the idea of Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities?
I guess I'm not entirely familiar with that. I guess I'm somewhat uninformed, but I would love to see it be more resilient.
So let me talk a little bit about the 100 Cities Initiative. Okay, so the Rockefeller Foundation in 2013 has created an organization called the 100 Resilient Cities, and that was their goal in 2013. So they started with 34 cities in the United States. They started with 32 cities in the United States. And then by 2014, they had over 300 applications for 95 other nations that were looking for the help of the idea of resiliency. And one of the things that they've done in Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, Denver, I can't think, Chicago is another one. There's some other ones in here. There's 32 of them in the United States. What they did is created a position called a resiliency officer. And that person's sole job was to create disaster resilient communities within the cities, that are focused. And so they have some money, they have some research that's backing them up, that concept. And I spoke about the resilient cities at a TEDx talk that I had, a few months ago. And what I was basically saying is that organizations like what you're talking about here, your civil defense organizations, or CERT programs, stuff like this, other civic minded organizations, can really play a huge role in the concept of the disaster resilient cities. So my question is, with your organization, how do you see them fitting into the big picture of a disaster resilient community?
I guess with my organization, we've always focused on advanced preparedness. We're not so much into the initial response, but I think, in looking at the issue, there's just no way for, say, the government with their few first responders, the firemen and police, they can't really make a dent where they're like a couple of tenths of a percent of the population. The only really way to do it is to
inform the population and to help them and encourage them to get prepared. So I guess that's always what we have tried to do. You know, it would be great if we had more of a political will to do that. I am thinking of there was a person that was a member of our board for a little while named Kirk Paradise. He actually put together a great program. He was the emergency manager for Huntsville, Alabama, and he basically went through and they had designated shelters, and I would say he, you know, went a long way being in that emergency manager position for the city in making that a resilient city. You know, I was very impressed with what he had done. He has since passed away at way too young of an age, but he did a great job, and I know that's his efforts and how he organized that were also recorded in the journal. But I think if there's a little bit of political will and public support, you know, you can go a long way with a relatively modest amount of resources. It just takes the right plan, the right vision, I guess.
I agree 100%.
Yeah, leadership is important at all levels. That's one of the things that I'm promoting when I promote civil defense in the communities. I believe that preparedness starts in the home. It's the family, or it's your home, it's your neighborhood, it's your community. That's how it needs to be built. There's a graphic from the 50s that I have on the website, and on Civil Defense Virginia website, actually. And it portrays that beautifully, how it goes from the individual, actually, to the family, to the neighborhood, to the community. And it's a building process. It's a way to help your neighbor. It's a way to be prepared and just be a good, involved citizen in everybody's mutual welfare and defense. It just makes common sense.
Right.
How do you address the criticisms from, and I say criticisms lightly, but they're still there, from people who think like organizations such as yours as just another, and I hate this TV show, but as another like doomsday prepper type person, that you're not there for society, you're just there for a crazy conspiracy theory. How do you address that criticism?
You know, I do get that quite a bit. I'm a very vocal advocate of being prepared, and I, you know, go out and, I teach a class, or at least arrange for a class for our local, civil defense volunteers of Utah every month. And I'm always trying to promote that, and people, you know, get that quite a bit. You know, why are you such a gloom and doomer? And I said, au contraire, you know, I'm the one that thinks you can survive this, and largely survival is a matter of attitude. So, you know, if you have a little bit of information and can make a few advanced preparations, you'll be in much better shape. And I also talk to people that want to die, and they don't want to live through anything that's going to challenge them substantially, and that's really unfortunate. And then I've talked to a surprising number of people that say that their plan is to take advantage of other people when things get rough. You know, that one guy, straight faced, as serious as ever, he just says, I'm former military, I have weapons, I know people that have food, and I plan on going and taking that food. And I was aghast. You know, I said, you wouldn't spend a few hundred dollars on food storage to keep from becoming a murderer, or at least a robber in a disaster situation. And, he didn't have much of an answer for me, but, it is unfortunate, but, you know, we're the ones that are actually have a good attitude, and I would say most people have a little bit of a fear in the back of their mind and a little pit in their stomach, especially when you start talking about these things, because they are unprepared and they don't know what to do, and, that can change substantially once you do have a little bit of information. So that's what we try to do, is give people information and encouragement, and a lot of times I give people a large dose of motivation, and I try to just describe how bad things could get, try to use their own children and the people that say they don't want to survive. I, that's usually my first retort is, okay, what are you going to do about your kids? You can't leave them without any protection or anyone to take care of them. So, you know, it's best to just take this a little bit seriously, make a few preparations. And at least in the area where I am, it's easy. You know, I live in Utah, where at least the predominant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or Mormon Church recommends that people have a year's supply of food. Roughly only about 5% of them do that, but still there is a substantial food storage industry here, and you can walk into most supermarkets and buy 5 gallon buckets of wheat. And you know, all ready to go, and there's several companies that can provide other types of freeze-dried foods and things of that nature. So basically we're all set up, and it's just a matter of spending a few hundred dollars per person to get that year's supply of food in this area. So, you know, it leaves a lot of people without excuse. And I actually I have responsibilities with what we call a stake, which is a group of 6 to 10 congregations. And I'm actually the liaison for those congregations with the city as part of the CERT program. So, and so I'm involved in the CERT, and we're trying to build the block captain program and things of that nature in order to basically looking on people in the event of a disaster. And we plan on, you know, sticking together, and I'm sure that we would be able to largely maintain order in a disaster situation, which wouldn't be the case in all situations. And I know my neighbors. I know several hundred of my neighbors that live, a couple of miles away. So that's, we have a substantial social fabric here, and I think we'll be able to do that. But there are people who, you know, call me a gloom and doomer, and I'm usually able to convince them that I'm the prudent one, and I'm not, well, I'm just getting ready in case something happens. I'm not, certainly not hoping for it, but I'm realistically expecting it to happen sometime.
That's so true. And it's funny you say that about the Mormon stakes. Doesn't have to be Utah, because they have them all over the place. And not too far away from where I live, there's a cannery. You can go in there and can your own food, or you can buy pre-canned stuff over there. So it's for those of you that are prepared and spine, you can reach out to your, LDS church and see where their cannery is. Some of them you have to be a member or have a sponsor, but some of them you can just go into, like the one that we go to in Fountain Valley, and you can do it on your own. You don't have to worry about being a member. So that's always
As a general policy of the church, I don't think that you do have to be a member, and you can actually order the food storage online. You can go to LDS.org and order the food storage online. It's all high quality, and I've been very pleased with the quality. The price is good, and so that's usually the place that I recommend that people start, is just going to the self-reliance part of the LDS.org website, and you can just order your food, and it shows up at your doorstep. So that's a really good way to go. And I did, before we go too far, I did want to mention, for anyone interested in looking at the Journal of Civil Defense and getting that information, we do not copyright our material, so you can download and copy and distribute at will, but you just go to TACTA.org. It's just the acronym for the American Civil Defense Association.org, and you can get all this information. And we've done our best to gather up everything, all the information that someone would need for long-term survival on their own, you know, in case they don't have a large support system in that area. And indeed, the LDS Church is basically a worldwide church. They have missionaries everywhere, so you can see that you can always find a missionary guest, and they can tell you where you can go get some food before the disaster.
You know, I'm on the resources tab here under TACTA Academy, and you have a lot of subjects here. You have psychology of civil defense, nuclear weapons effects, all hazard sheltering, chemical biological warfare, EMP, electromagnetic pulse and power failure, radiation, natural disasters, food storage, water purification, sanitation, which is what a lot of people forget about until it's too late, cold weather survival, evacuation and 72-hour kits, communications, alternative energy and fuel, medical preparedness, triage and first response, and post-event survival. You've got a lot of great information in there. I've read through a lot of this, and I've made up a little book of the stuff that I've printed off so far. But I also have printed off some of your past journals, the from 2009, 2010, and in particular, the 2010 talks about a coronal mass ejection, and I read that cover to cover yesterday while sitting on our deck. We just happened to have some nice sunshine for a change, and it was pleasant enough to sit outside instead of being freezing cold. And I read it while I was smoking a cigar and just enjoying the sun. So there was a lot of great information in there, and I plan on sharing that far and wide.
That's great. That's what it's there for, is we're just sharing it, you know, offering it to the world to use at will. But, you know, I would say it's the greatest collection of survival information that I can think of, basically. We have tried to cover everything, and we've had roughly two decades to do it, you know, since I've been involved with the organization. And so I think we're fairly thorough, and we keep our eyes open, and if something else comes up or somebody gets a new idea, then we use that. You know, the next journal coming out, I've got a couple of articles on hypothermia and frostbite, and, you know, recovering from frostbite and such. So, you know, something that I know we've covered cold weather survival, but I hadn't really covered the you know, the what things go bad, I guess, as far as a cold weather situation. And so, anyway, we keep adding to it all the time.
Yes. And I invite you to add civildefenseradio.com to your resource links under your resources tab there, with Michael Mabee's link to his book and some of the other things that you have there. Some really, really good links.
Yeah, we will do that. And we're very, and, you know, if we can help or coordinate or anything that you can think of, you know, do let us know. We are a relatively small organization, fairly modest resources. We're, the organization is largely supported by selling medical emergency triage tags, and mainly first responder type people. So we have a little bit of few resources, I guess, associated with that, and you know, what we sell on the store. And actually, with the store, the Tactus store that we have there, we're mainly just trying to make available things that you don't necessarily find in your local area, things that might be kind of hard to find. It's not trying to be everything to everybody, but just something that's kind of unusual. We try to offer it there just as a resource for people, basically.
Yeah, well, you have the complete CERT starter kit, and it's reasonably priced as well. So anybody out there looking for a starter kit for their CERT team, well, you know where to go to get it now. And for $32.95, it looks pretty complete to me, with helmet, bag, goggles, flashlight, batteries, all kinds of stuff. Some tools there, the complete kit. So, Civil Defense Radio believes in and promotes CERT. We also promote the Map Your Neighborhood program. And we believe that that's a first step to get the community talking about preparedness.
Right, that's good. That's what we've tried to do as well. Work through the neighbors, the local church organizations, and the city, I guess, to try and promote preparedness. And when it comes right down to it, it's pretty straightforward, easy to do. You got lots of people give you some guidance and such. It's just having the will to do that, making it a giving at least a little bit of priority, and you can do a lot with relatively modest resources.
Oh, yeah. All right. Anything else you have over there, Todd, you want to ask Jay?
No, I think we covered it all. So I just want to say thank you for coming on the show, and I'd love to talk to you again sometime.
Absolutely. You know, we'd love to work together with you anytime, in any way that we can. Collectively, we'd love to work together with you, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we appreciate your help in spreading the word.
Yeah, Jay, well, I appreciate it, and we will be in touch on a regular basis. There's some things that I'd like to work with you on. I think our organizations can team up and help spread this word of the need for civil defense be brought back under a new American civil defense structure.
Absolutely. That's our goal, basically. So thank you very much. I appreciate your efforts.
Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.